Welcome to the Tennis Worthy Podcast as we dust the dirt off of our clay court shoes and get ready to slide into the second major of the year, the French Open at famed Roland Garros in Paris. Hello, I'm Patrick McEnroe, the president of the International Tennis Hall of Fame. And if you think you know the home of French tennis very well, this podcast will be a very good test for you because we've got an in-depth interview with one of the most knowledgeable people about Roland Garros, the former Reuters Paris Bureau sports writer and editor, and also current president of the French Tennis Federation's press commission, François Tamazel.
Everything was changing fast, and Philippe Chatrier in France was the guy who realized all that. He was one of the promoters of the Open era in France, but in general. He was aware that you needed to bring in the pros to play with the amateurs if you wanted tennis to keep it probably in France to survive. And that's what he did. 1991 was really the moment when it all changed. And then gradually we started winning everything. I mean, football, World Cup, in other sports as well. And all of a sudden we changed from a country that loved losers to a country that started to love winners. You've got the Cannes Film Festival roughly at the same period where I think for lots of people to be spotted on TV, on center court watching the Roland Garros tennis final means you've made it.
Roland Garros has been home to the world's most prestigious tournament on red clay since 1928, when it was built for France to host that year's Davis Cup final. But it was heavily modernized from the early 1970s by one of the most dynamic administrators in the history of tennis, the Hall of Famer Philippe Chatrier. Chris Bauer sat down with François Tamazel and began by asking him whether there's a buzz in the lead-up to Roland Garros, not just in the French sports circles, but in France as a whole.
There's always been a buzz. I mean, Roland Garros is a very special event in France, as you know. It's like a seasonal event. Throughout the year, you have a number of events like that, that when they're coming, that you can feel the excitement coming up. Well, you have the Tour de France in July is one. But of course, Roland Garros, the French who like that tennis, they call it Roland. It's like an old friend, you know, when it's coming back. And you can tell, you know, in mid-May, that the excitement is coming up. I mean, you know, the tennis community, we're excited by all the Grand Slam tournaments and there's a buzz, you know, before each of them. But in France, it is Roland. That's the thing that matters. And to the whole of the population. I'll take an example. When I was a tennis journalist working for Reuters, I was sports editor in Paris. You know, all the guys in the press room at Reuters, they would never ask me for football tickets or rugby tickets or whatever. But every time mid-May came, they would all flock to my desk and say, "Oh, François, wouldn't you have some tickets for Roland Garros?" So, as I say, Roland Garros, even outside of tennis, is the place to be. Is, you know, you've got the Cannes Film Festival roughly at the same period. These are two events taking place roughly at the same time where I think for lots of people to be spotted on TV, on center court watching the Roland Garros tennis final means you've made it.
Wow. Okay, we'll come back to that later in the interview. But in terms of the four Grand Slam tournaments, three of the four were in private clubs. One of them still is Wimbledon. The US and the Australian have switched to their own national tennis centres. Roland Garros was built in 1928 for the Davis Cup final, but was it a national tennis center then, or did the national tennis center come much later?
It was a little bit tricky because at the time you had most of the tennis facilities for French tennis were actually elsewhere in Saint-Cloud, but it all started, you know, in Puteaux, which is a small town, well, no, quite a big town south of Paris, where they started playing tennis. And then the most of the tennis would take place in Saint-Cloud, which is not too far away from Roland Garros. But it was really the success of, well, Suzanne Lenglen for one, but and then the success by the Musketeers and the craze that came in France, you know, the media craze and for the public who discovered tennis through the Musketeers about the Davis Cup final that made it necessary to find a place, to find a spot where you could build a decent tennis stadium. It was more of a stadium, actually, because you had this club feeling that you around Paris that you have probably, as you said, in Wimbledon or probably at Queens. You know, you still get this club, tennis club feeling. But all those places were too small for the Davis Cup final. So they were looking for grounds where they could build the stadium. And you know, Chris, you know Roland Garros, you know the place, you know the area. And this area of Paris is, when you're in that area, you're still in Paris, but in the same time, you're not in Paris anymore. There's these kind of village green atmosphere or even forest, because it is in a forest, actually, you know, the Bois de Boulogne. And in the beginning of the 20th century, all these sportsmen, you know, all these kids from the French bourgeoisie who wanted to emulate the English and run and jump and, you know, play football, play rugby, and play. They were all looking for grounds to practice the new trend that was sport. And so they were all granted grounds in the same area, which is the area of Roland Garros, which is in the 16th arrondissement, close to Boulogne-Billancourt and Saint-Cloud and all those areas. So lots of different sports clubs were granted grounds at the time by the Paris municipality to play football, to play rugby. And two main clubs emerged at the time. They still exist. The Racing Club de France, which was mainly a rugby team at the beginning, and the Stade Français was still a very important rugby team to this day, and own the Stade Jean-Bouin, the Jean-Bouin Stadium, which is, everybody who's gone to Roland Garros knows Jean-Bouin, because when you walk to the Roland Garros Stadium, you see it in a distance. So
and the players practice there, don't they, during Roland Garros?
Yeah, absolutely. They've got tennis grounds there as well. I mean, you can train there. So at the time when the French Federation were looking for a place, they asked Stade Français had grounds available. So they asked the people at Stade Français, could you grant us or lease us or, you know, sell us this spot that's available? And so he was actually a guy called Émile Le Sieur. He was a French rugby international. Well off, they were all well off at the time, you know, rugby players. But and he said, "Yeah, we have these grounds. We can, you know, make them available for you." And actually, Émile Le Sieur's best friend was a guy called Roland Garros, who was a member of the Stade Français, who had played rugby for the Stade Français, and he was a famous airman, one of the pioneers of French, you know, aviation and famous aircraft pilots, and he died. Like many of these, you know, air pioneers at the time. And as a member of Stade Français, well, it was decided to give a name to that new facility. Émile Le Sieur insisted that, you know, it was called Roland Garros. Yeah, as you said, they seized the opportunity of the Davis Cup final in 1928, made it possible to build that stadium, and gradually it became the home of French tennis, but it was not, you know, in the first place, as you said.
Yeah, I can testify to the character of Boulogne, which is at the western edge of Roland Garros, is very different to the character of Paris, even the 16th district on the east. So yes, absolutely agree with that one. So let's jump forward 40, 45 years from the foundation of Roland Garros in 1928 to tennis going open in 68. And in the early 70s, there was this feeling that Roland Garros was slightly falling behind, certainly Wimbledon, possibly the US Open, less so the Australian. Tell me about the emergence of Philippe Chatrier and how he saw his role in modernizing Roland Garros.
Well, I think that he actually ended up modernizing tennis. I think he was the right man at the right place at the right time. I was too young, so I can tell you about Roland Garros in 1968. Actually, Roland Garros 1968 took place in May, so during the riots in the streets of Paris. And friends were telling me that to escape from, to run away from the tensions and the riots and the fighting in the streets of Paris, they would go to Roland Garros, and it was only what, 5-6 miles away, and you could go to that kind of leisurely, as you said, you know, garden party atmosphere. And so Roland Garros in 1968 was still very relaxed, very amateur, very, like, you know, posh people meeting up, you know, they're drinking wine, looking at a tennis game. So it was yeah, kind of low key, to be honest. And it's funny to imagine that at the same time you had guys fighting in the streets and only 5 miles away, you could go and relax by watching a tennis game. But everybody said the same. It was nice to have that friendly family atmosphere, but it was not professional tennis at all at the time. So I guess that Philippe Chatrier, he had been a good tennis player. I think he was French number six. At best, he played for France with the Davis Cup a couple of matches, and he was Davis Cup captain as well. So he had this side of him that was a tennis player who probably like the guys at this time kind of remembered the craze of the Musketeers, that you still had that shadow, you know, looming over French tennis at the time, where the Musketeers have done that, but where are we now? Like I guess, you know, as you know, British tennis, you know, waited for a long time to find a successor to Fred Perry. So I think there was the same feeling of longing for something better and something new. And Philippe Chatrier was also a journalist. I think that for all of his career, he saw himself more as a journalist than as a sports official in many ways, which is interesting. So being a former player, being a journalist, being aware of the environment of tennis in general, he ended up being married to a British tennis player. He could see what Wimbledon was like, what the US Open was like. He could feel the atmosphere changing. He could feel that if France wanted to get back to the time of the Musketeers and find new strengths and new talents, something needed to change. And he became in charge of French tennis precisely at the same time when the whole of the tennis world realized that, you know, you needed something to change. The women that, you know, were working behind to create the WTA, I mean, everything was changing fast. And so Philippe Chatrier in France was the guy who realized all that. It was, you know, he could catalyze it. He said, and he realized it was time to, he was one of the promoters of the Open era in France, but in general. He was aware that you needed to bring in the pros to play with the amateurs if you wanted tennis to keep it probably in France to survive. And that's what he did. Of course, Roland Garros was also a great tool to help, you know, rebuilding French tennis. And he also launched a very, you know, important campaign to scout talents and discover new talents, which led to the rise of players like Yannick Noah, Henri Lecomte, Guy Forget. And they were, I think they saw themselves, you know, as Philippe Chatrier's kids in many ways.
I wanted to come back to that because in some ways Noah's title in 83 was the completion of the project. But let's just go back a couple of steps. We'll get on to Chatrier being the ITF president as well. But what did he do to modernize Roland Garros in the 70s?
Well, as I said, in 68, you have this garden party atmosphere and it's still very amateurish and everything. He was a builder. He built courts. That's one major thing. A major thing he did, because when Roland Garros in 1928 was built, it was just one court. I mean, you needed one court for the final. Then, of course, courts were added for training and things. And when he took over, I think there were 9 courts at Roland Garros. In a matter of a few years, he built 9 new courts. So he really turned Roland Garros from garden party club, he turned it into a real tennis complex, and so that was important as well, because all of a sudden, because of the Open era, sometimes you have this kind of miracles. I remember as a kid, 1968, 1969, nobody cared about tennis at all. Then all of a sudden, turn of the 70s, you could see it growing and growing and growing, and Bjorn Borg and John McEnroe and even before, even Rod Laver, Ken Rosewall, Chris Evert, Jon Tyriac. I mean, all these games suddenly started to become household names in France. I don't know how it came, but gradually, I think what he did as well is, being a journalist, he realized very quickly that you needed the TV, you needed the radio, and you needed the press, you needed a newspaper like L'Equipe, and he created a tennis magazine called Tennis de France, which quickly became one of probably the world reference tennis magazine. So he built courts, he reorganized the whole setup, he scouted talents and launched a training program for young players. But also, being a journalist, he launched a real media campaign, like, you know, making sure tennis was a sport that people talked about, and that's what happened. And, you know, as a fan, I could witness it, because from one day to the other, Jimmy Connors was totally unknown by anyone in France, probably in 1969, and it became, everybody knew that Jimmy Connors was a tennis player like 5 or 6 years later, which was amazing.
In the mid-70s, there were 6 years of world team tennis, which had its own season, and it had a break for Wimbledon, but it didn't have a break for Roland Garros. Did that hurt Chatrier? Did Chatrier think, we must not have a situation where the top players miss our tournament because they're playing team tennis?
Yeah. I mean, there was obviously, and as you know, it took a long time to kind of solve that problem in a way. Sports and politics and geopolitics have always been very, you know, intricate. I mean, you know, coming together. And even though he never said so, probably as bluntly as I'm going to say it, but as there was always a sense there was the Anglo-Saxon word seen from France, that is, you know, Britain, America, Australia, that they were all together against us, the frogs, you know. And then Philippe Chatrier, I think, was very aware of it. And he wanted to show, look, the French, we're part of this history of tennis. We won the Davis Cup many times, and we deserve more respect, you know. Also, as you know, well, the surface, you know, we were playing on clay. The rest of the world playing on grass. This whole dispute between beer and wine countries, and, you know, between garlic in the south. And so this kind of cultural rivalry between the Latin countries and what we see as the Anglo-Saxon world, which doesn't mean anything, but, you know.
But you say that, Francois, you said that he was married to an English woman, Susan Partridge. When he worked at the International Lawn Tennis Federation from 76, he had a general secretary, David Gray, who was a British journalist. He was surrounded by Anglo-Saxon influence. Was it like a chip on his shoulder that never left him? Or did he see it as a battle to try and get people to help him make Roland Garros as good as the other three?
Well, in a way, I'm well placed to talk about it, being a French Anglophile, you know. I think that's what Philippe Chatrier was as well. If you go back to 1928 and even before that, I mean, there was the whole development of sport in France, of tennis in France, came from some sort of the fascination for Britain and kind of Anglophilia. And so at the time, I guess in the late 60s, early 70s, you couldn't be a tennis fan, tennis official, and a prominent figure in the world of tennis if you were not Anglophile, because you needed to go to Wimbledon, you needed to be aware of the American tennis, you know, college circuit, and all these cultural differences. You actually needed to put them all together and to take the best out of each one, or you know, well, Australia, I suppose, you know, being so far away from the rest of the tennis world, I suppose, probably suffered the same kind of a problem, like to be accepted, like the fourth Grand Slam being so far away, and for many years, as you know, players couldn't go there, they had to take the boats for ages and blah, blah, blah. And even now, I think there's still this, I won't say burden of history, but the weight of history made probably Wimbledon and the All England Club seen as the moral authority of tennis, and you needed to make friends with them. You couldn't clash with them. You had to accept, probably like the Tour de France in cycling, you had to accept that this was the monument, and it deserves respect. So you couldn't fight them. Frankly, you had to make friends with them. So yeah, I think Chatrier was an Anglophile, and he spent probably the first part of his career trying to convince well, the Anglo-Saxon world seen from France, that French tennis was worth it, you know? And I think he did.
And do you think he ever achieved that? Or do you think he felt he achieved it?
I think he did achieve that. As you know, there have been times, there's always going to be ups and downs in kind of, you know, as I said, the geopolitics of sports and of tennis in general. Like 15 or 20 years ago, that there were rumors, oh yeah, well, of the French Open, before they rebuilt the stadium, you know, again, there were those rumors that, the facilities are not up to Grand Slam level. It's, you know, you can't compare it to what you find in Wimbledon or the US Open or Melbourne. And so, you know, for a few months, you had that rumor that Paris might be replaced by Madrid because you had all these Spanish players, blah, blah, blah. So the tensions will never cease to exist in a way. But yeah, I guess that by the time Philippe Chatrier retired in the mid-90s and before his death in 2000, I think he'd won it. It definitely won it.
There are two moments in French tennis, well, I would say in tennis in general, which to me sum up the ecstasy of sport. One was Yannick Noah winning at Roland Garros in 83. Mm-hmm. And the other was France winning the Davis Cup in Lyon in 1991. The scenes of joy and exuberance and exhilaration among the crowd were, you don't have to be French to just... If you experience those, to enjoy the passion and the wonder that sport can create, did Chatrier see that as his crowning glory, as the completion of his project?
Yeah. 1983 was a little bit different because it was an individual victory by Noah, but still... Since Noah was in a way the kind of brainchild of Philippe Chatrier, so he was also a personal victory for him. Obviously, he saw probably Yannick as a member of his family, and lots of French people at the time saw Yannick Noah as a member of their family. It was kind of a one-off, you know, feat by Noah as a player, because he was a great player. He was number four in the world at one time, but it's the only slam he won. But yeah, it was touching and was emotional because we all built a kind of personal relationship with Yannick Noah. He was, you know, he was, yeah, exuberant, flashy, good looking, funny. I mean, he had spectacular. He had all sorts of qualities that made him very endearing to the public. So that was the first step, as you say. I think 1991 was much more important. I think it was a crowning achievement. After 1991, I think Philippe Chatrier realized, okay, I can go now. We've made it. We won the Davis Cup again. And I was in Lyon. I think you were too, Chris. But it was, as you say, I mean, it was in this Gerland Stadium, which was a rather old stadium. And as you might remember, the press room was beneath the court. And when we were going down to write our stories or to the noise on top of our heads of people, you know, thumping the tribunes, and it was absolutely amazing. It was like a kind of pagan ritual or something. But it was, yeah, it was absolutely amazing. And, you know, I'm not making self... advertising here, but we ended up with my friend Fabrice Abgras, who's been following tennis, you know, for France, French radio forever. With Fabrice, we wrote a book called 1991, The Birth of Winning France. Because the thing was, before 1991 and before the 1990s, there was a kind of, how could I put it? The French didn't win that much anymore in any sport, you know. In football, we were beaten all the time. It was before, we'd won the European Cup, with the European Championship with Michel Platini. But, you know, it was pretty rare. And we were more, actually, I think the French fans, sports fans in general, were more sympathetic to the runners-up and to the guys who had fought well, you know, the magnificent losers. That's what we liked. Well, we liked a guy who comes to the final, fights, but loses. And we in a way, there was a general tendency to like the underdog better than the winners. We would all of a sudden, France started to win again,
And I think 1991 was really the moment when it all changed. And then gradually we started winning everything. I mean, football, World Cup, in other sports as well. And all of a sudden we changed from a country that loved losers to a country that started to love winners, which was a great philosophical change of mind, you know. So yeah, there was a really turning point. Really,
it's part of the rite of passage of getting away from the garden party when you actually learn to win. It's a change of culture. You mentioned earlier about Roland Garros is the place where people want to be seen. If you're a celebrity, you want to be caught on camera there, or a photographer takes a picture of you. When did that happen? And do you think Chatrier felt that was part of the project, part of the success of the modernization?
Certainly, because he also created the village where, as you know, the village of you can be accredited to Roland Garros and not be accredited to the village. The village being the place where the sponsors, the partners, and so all the big companies, the politicians, everyone wants to go to the village, should be invited to. You know, you've got guys who come to Roland Garros only to sip champagne in a tent and watching tennis on the TV, and you know, being treated to foie gras and whatever. So it's also part of the trendy part of Roland Garros is also a creation of Philippe Chatrier. You know, he wanted to attract sponsors and attract money and attract the elite, the jet set. So he not only was he aware of that, but he was probably instrumental in bringing that to the way it is now. I think, as far as I remember, it started being very, very trendy to be seen at Roland Garros from from the mid and late 70s onwards. That's when it all started. The main figure that really changed everything in my mind was Bjorn Borg. You know, I remember lots of my friends. I was still in high school at the time, but lots of my friends, they had Donny rackets and they had the Bjorn Borg, you know.
Sweatbands
and posters in their rooms, and it all of a sudden, you know, tennis players in the mid 70s became like rock stars, and they looked like rock stars as well. So you could have a poster of, I don't know, Led Zeppelin and Bjorn Borg next to one another, and that's when the image of tennis and of tennis players changed radically. To be honest, when I was in high school and then at university, Roland Garros always come at the time when you're studying for your end of the term exams. They're usually they're in June, so all the students in France, you know, they know that there is a problem because for 2 weeks you have to work hard on your exams and your tests and everything, and in the same time there's the French Open on TV. So I mean, I remember we used to meet about three or four of us, you know, studying together and, you know, our lessons and everything, and there was always, you know, a clay court on TV in the background, and we were watching that. It had become part of our lives, you know, of our it was part of being young at the time, you know, and I think it still is. I know quite a few youngsters now, unfortunately, you know, that they're my kids or my grandkids, but they're still the same, as we said in the beginning, the same buzz, the same excitement. Oh, it's soon going to be Roland Garros. And so, yeah, it's probably the same, you know, in cricket test match season, you know, it's part of everyday life. And that's the good thing about Roland Garros and about tennis or about cricket, about the Tour de France. It goes on and on. So you can put the TV on and leave it on all day and go and doing things in the home, and all of a sudden you hear excitement on TV. Oh, so you run to see what's going on, and it really started in those mid 70s, I guess, and on.
And did he also introduce Kids Day? It was the first Wednesday, but because that always has a completely different atmosphere about it, because they let a whole load of that they're licensed players, aren't they? They're players who are members of French clubs who are probably a part of some training scheme, and they all get tickets for the first Wednesday.
Yeah, that's another thing that makes the French a little bit different from the other tournaments, even though I know it, the same applies to a certain extent in other slams. Actually, almost 70%, maybe at some time up to 80% of the tickets sold for Roland Garros go to tennis clubs and go to tennis players, you know, ordinary people with a tennis license who play in the club and who are members of the French Federation. So there, the priority when ticket sales go, when tickets go on sale, there's always been a contingent of those tickets reserved for people who play tennis in a club, which means that it's changed, of course, especially since we have the night sessions, so it's now more open to the general public. But the general public always had fewer tickets than real tennis fans, which means that actually the guys, the spectators on Centre Court, on Châtrier, on Suzanne Langdon, on all the courts are, well, you've always got a high proportion of people who actually do play tennis, you know, who are really tennis fans. Because Châtrier, he was on a mission, as you said, he was on a campaign to make tennis popular and to make tennis one of the most popular sports in France. I mean, I think that the number of in the first decade of Châtrier, you know, being at the head of the French Tennis Federation, the number of licensees jumped by six times. You know, there were six times more people playing tennis in a club than before he started, you know, being shadow of French tennis. So that was huge. And one part of it was that you really needed to have the kids for the kids to come see the champions. You know, that emulation. He realized how important it was to bring the kids on the Wednesday, because the Wednesday in France is the day when the kids don't go to school. So to make sure you had the magic of Roland Garros and magic of the Grand Slam tennis, you know, for us journalists, it was sometimes a problem, because on Kids Day, obviously it's you know, you get kids running all over the place, and it's far more difficult to, you know, walk your way around the courts, and as you said, the atmosphere is different. The screams are like more like shrieks, but you know, that's I think it was a very good idea actually, I've come across quite a few people who are ball boys, who became tennis officials and did, you know, and climbed the ladder all the way to the top of being in charge of tennis. I actually don't know anybody who first discovered Grand Slam tennis at Kids Day and then went on and on. But I'm sure there are thousands of them, and it was a good idea.
You mentioned the term. Well, it's not translatable, really. It's a term that only applies in French tennis. Licencié, somebody who is licensed to a club. I mean, in the rest of the world, it would just be a member of a club. The one thing I haven't asked you is, what was Châtrier like as a person? What sort of person was he? We think of him as a dynamic person, but what was he like to talk to be with, to have a glass of wine with?
It was funny because he was... He had a natural authority, so he was a little bit impressive. He was not impressive in physically, but he had this air of natural authority about him. But in the same time, he was extremely friendly, and especially with the press. I think he saw himself for the rest of his life as a journalist more than a tennis player or a tennis official. And he was very, very often coming to the press center and you know, just walk around, going to the press bar and chat with us. And also he did something to make it that clear, the way he saw the press as something important. He created what's called the press commission at Roland Garros, which is actually the people who decide who gets accredited to Roland Garros, whose media can come or not come, how the tribunes are organized, everything that related to the life of the press. It's actually decided by a committee of 11 people that are elected during the French Open. I know that because I was the president of the commission for 10 years. And it's Philippe Châtrier who created that. And so it shows how much he cared about the press. And so with us journalist, he was absolutely charming, and you could even tell he was almost begging for approval, that he, you know, claiming like, I'm still one of you guys, you know. And so yeah, now he was very, very, yeah, very, very easy to talk to, very accessible, much more so than the other presidents that came afterwards. I'm not making any complaints or criticism, but he was very open-minded.
Somebody I spoke to who worked with him said for a dynamic visionary, he could get very down on himself. He could get quite depressed at times. Is that something you saw?
Yeah. I'm not surprised about it. As I said, when I said he was begging for approval, that's what I'm saying. He still saw us at the time, you know, the tennis journalists as inspirations, or at least people knew what they were talking about and observers of the world of tennis. When I became a member of the press commission, he was coming, very often to talk to us, asking questions, asking for suggestions, I think. So I think he was probably a guy who doubted himself quite a lot. It's not an impression he gave in public, I mean, on TV or anything. And it's funny because he also had this, how could I put it? You remember in the days of Chatrier, the presidential tribune was not where it is now. And Chatrier, every major match, he was sitting there at the very middle of the presidential tribune. And he was like a king with the court around him. But in a way, he was a kind of a modest monarch. You know, he was there. And you could tell he was generally liked by... It's always easy to criticize people afterwards and say, especially people in high positions like he was. But I think he was generally liked. And he belonged also, he really also belonged to a long tradition of French sports officials, like, you know, Coubertin that created the Olympics. The Football World Cup was created by a Frenchman. The Football Champions League was also created by a French journalist. The Tour de France was created by a French journalist. At one stage, the head of the FIA, the Automobile International Federation, was a French journalist as well. So he belonged to a long tradition of French journalists who changed the organization of sports in general. I think he was aware of being part of that dynamic. But as you say, in the same time, he always said, yeah, very, very modest. And he could be, one minute he was at the center of the presidential tribune with all the jet sets and around him, and sometimes really had heads of state and everything. And like 15 minutes later, he was at the press bar chatting to you and asking if we enjoyed the game, you know, so that he had that twofold personality.
When we think of the world's great stadiums, we have the Arthur Ashe Stadium in New York. We have the Rod Laver Arena in Melbourne. And there are other stadiums named after players. Pietrangeli has the old centre court at the Foro Italico named after him in Rome. Yeah. And think of the Caja Mágica in Madrid. It's very unusual to have an administrator whose name adorns a tennis stadium. Was there a lot of controversy, or was it a difficult decision in the late 90s when the second of Chatrier's building plans for the centre court at Roland Garros came to fruition to name it after him?
I don't think so, but because I think everybody acknowledged that he was, I mean, everything that was around there, and especially this center court, owes a lot to him, to Philippe Chatrier. He also was a player, as I said, you know, he was not a great player, but he was a player. So he was not entirely only he actually was a good representative of all the populations of the stadium, like the players. He was a player, the journalist. He was a journalist. You have a press tribune and TV stand, and the officials. So he was. And as I said, you know, I don't think sports administrators in the rest of the world are, you know, as public figures like they might have been in France, like The Football World Cup was called La Coupe Jules Rimet for many years because Jules Rimet invented it, you know. And in all that the periods when French sport was not doing so well, the only thing we had left was administrators. So it was only natural that we name a stadium after one of them. No, I'm joking about it, but it's you know, as like most jokes, there's parts of truth in there.
Exactly, there's an element of truth. Absolutely. The centre court at Roland Garros has been rebuilt three times, actually. Twice were Chatrier's plans. And then in 2018, it was knocked down and rebuilt. And yet it looks remarkably similar to what it looked like before. Is there an element of today's Philippe Chatrier Arena that is actually, it stayed the way he designed it by, even though it's completely rebuilt.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, parts of the stadium were listed, you know, as historic monuments. So that there were parts they couldn't destroy, especially, you know, the cross, the concrete crosses.
They call it the Cross of St. Andrew, don't they? Which is,
yeah, yeah.
But I'm told that that was, just to say, concrete in the late 20s when they built the stadium because the concrete was expensive.
That's right. It's probably true. But they only had been listed, so you couldn't destroy them. It's funny because my last 2 years as the head of the press commission, where we spent lots and lots of meetings discussing the building of the new stadium, and we showed the plans, and we went to see the workers and how he was going up. And there was actually, if you take, for instance, the French Federation headquarters, which are just beneath the stadium, everything was kept the same. I mean, the underground of, so they rebuilt on top of, but the let's say the first floor or the first story of the stadium and the ground floor, everything remained the same. So they actually rebuilt, and they had to keep the listed parts of it. So yeah, as you say, to be honest, I don't feel so much at home anymore in the new stadium because I'm not a great fan of these huge open space press rooms, but never mind. And so things have changed, but basically the structure, there were some parts of the stadium that they kept, that they were part of the old press facilities as we've known them, Chris, and they were so good and, you know, so reflective of Chatrier's love for the press, that when they rebuilt the stadium, they kept those places, but they gave them to the players.
That's, I'm afraid, the way of the tennis world. That's not just a French problem.
I'm thinking of the press bar, you know, which was the press bar we had for 20 years before they rebuilt the stadium, where it was really a place where was really a special place inside the Roland Garros, where lots of things happened. I mean, journalists met, discussed the future of tennis, but you could meet the administrators, the guys from the federation. You could meet ATP officials, WTA officials, ITF officials. You could meet Philippe Chatrier himself. Players were coming for birthdays and stuff. It was really a little bubble of intimacy, you know, inside this huge stadium. It's gone and now it's part of the players' lounge.
Yeah, I mean, because players are traveling with bigger entourages these days, and therefore they
That's
want
right.
more space for themselves. I think it's also fair to say that the media, the press and the broadcasters are perhaps a little bit more responsible with the amount of alcohol they drink than was the case 20,
sure.
30 years ago.
Sure.
Which is probably needs to be added. François, can we finish by, I'd like to ask you for a personal reflection. Obviously, you've spent a lifetime chronicling the growth of French tennis, in particular Roland Garros. What is the most special or magical thing about Roland Garros for you?
So it's difficult because it's changed quite a bit, but, well, I mentioned the press bar, but still, yeah, I still believe that mixture of huge sports facility and little birth of intimacy, it's still there. I mean, remember, there was a time when it was overcrowded and he wanted to go from Chatrier to Suzanne Lenglen for the other court. There was a small path, you know, behind a house where you could sneak your way through and then you avoid the crowd. So you still had these little spots where, and that's where they were breeding hawks. They still do, you know, to hunt for rats. And so you still have these little corners of intimacy and I must say that there are two things I always used to do when I was coming towards, yeah, what was actually my holiday house, my holiday home for May and June for 30 years. I would always go to the outside courts, to the court 18, 19 to watch the juniors, because you were absolutely brought back to the garden party times before Chatrier. In the first round of junior tournaments, you have the parents, you have a few friends, you have a handful of people watching tennis just for the fun of it. I'm glad that this still exists because once again,
only 100 yards away, you might have a major game on major match being played on the Châtrier court. And in the same time, two young kids are playing their lives, you know, are really fighting it to the limit, you know, in a small court with only a handful of spectators. And almost every day I would go for like 20 minutes to this kind of refreshing atmosphere. And another thing I've done very often before and sometimes during the finals, I was going to the gardens, you know, the Serre d'Auteuil. I used to go there. Of course, they preserved part of the garden, but I used to go there because, especially when I was chairing the press commission, because when the final started and everybody was seated and I done my job, I made sure I didn't have a seat as a head of press commission, because there were so many quests that we always made sure, you know, I always left my seat to another journalist so that we could have more people. So I was always standing, you know, in the tribune. And when everybody was sitting, and after a couple of games, I thought, okay, it's all underway now, there's no more problem. I would often go and listen to the first set or a few games from the gardens, because yet you are in this very cool and quiet atmosphere with birds and plants and the rumor of the stadium, and you could really follow the match very well. You knew exactly what was going on just from the crowd sound. I would not spend lots of time there, because I needed to get back in case there was a problem and I wanted to see the end of the game. But I've done it quite a few times, and that's what I like about the French Open, that mixture of a huge sporting event and in the same time, yeah, the survival of the garden party atmosphere. That's what I like.
So when you walk through the gates on the first day of Roland Garros, what will you feel?
It's just been back home, really. I mean, I it's changed now, because I'm not covering tennis as much as I used to, and for the past 10 years, I've come in and out, and since they rebuilt the stadium, it's like they've changed my holiday home quite a bit. So there's no nostalgia or anything about it, but it's less my home than it used to be. But I did all editions from 1986 onwards until 2016, and really when I was coming back, he was really like I could have come in, you know, I had the impression I could have come with flip-flops, and it was really like my holiday home. I was really feeling like I knew all the corners. I knew lots of people. You were walking down the lanes, and you know, always meeting old friends, or you know, and when I was heading the press commission, I was walking along the court, and guys were walking across, coming my way, calling me a high president. So I mean, you know, it was a strange feeling to be president for 2 weeks. So it was fun. So yeah, I really felt at home, very much at home in at the French Open and at Roland Garros in general.
Well, François Tomazeau, thank you very much for letting us into your holiday home and for sharing your thoughts on Roland Garros and Philippe Chatrier.
Thanks, Chris.